The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, America, on this Monday, April 26, 2021. Good to have you. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway this morning. If you did not watch the Oscars, like the vast, vast majority of Americans, let me just give you the rundown. If you want to, if you were afraid of spoilers, now is the time to turn off your radio. Best Picture, Nomadland. Best Actress, Frances McDormand in Nomadland. Best Supporting Actress, Yeon Yun-jung in Minari. Best Director, Chloe Zhao in Nomadland. Best Actor, Anthony Hopkins in The Father. Best Supporting Actor, Daniel Kaluuya in Judah and the Black Messiah. And I think I told you Best Picture was Nomadland. If you don't know who Daniel Kaluuya is, he was the border guard, head of the border tribe in Black Panther. Chadwick Boseman was the favorite to win Best Actor, but he lost to Anthony Hopkins. Chadwick Boseman, of course, tragically dying earlier in the year. And so there was a little bit of a letdown at the end, although I thought Anthony Hopkins was going to win from the beginning. The L.A. Times headline, this year's Oscar had cinematic flair in a grand setting. Too bad they couldn't reshoot that ending. They ended, for some odd reason, not with Best Picture, but with Best Actor. And that's when Anthony Hopkins won, who wasn't anywhere to be found. So that's your movie news. And it wasn't a very good year for the movies because nobody went. Nobody has seen most of these movies, and nobody really cares, and nobody knows. You know, the actors are very proud of their achievement, as they should be, but it's like winning a race for the 50-year-olds and older when there aren't that many people running, or winning a potato sack race because, you know, it really depends on your partner. There just aren't that many films in contention this year. A lot of people put movies on the shelf until people could go back to the movies. I myself saw Mortal Kombat in a theater this weekend. That is not a children's movie. That's all I'll say about that. To the real news, India shaken by new coronavirus surge. This is from the Washington Post. The Prime Minister Modi on Sunday urged all citizens to get vaccinated as soon as possible. The numbers are extraordinary. There are 349,000 new cases yesterday. 2,767 reported deaths, and those numbers are probably going to go up. It's up to the United States to rush them aid. They are a crucial ally in the showdown with the People's Republic of China, and we really, really do need Team Biden to get into the game. India airlifts medical supplies from everywhere. When you get 350,000 new infections on Saturday, you need new supplies from everywhere. And people are calling home, and of course, their lockdowns don't make a lot of sense. More than 20 patients died at one private hospital in Delhi when the oxygen ran out. So it's not just PPP or PPE. It is everything. They need everything. Meanwhile, in the Wall Street Journal, the West looks past COVID-19. They see an economic resurgence. After the worst year for the global economy since the Great Depression, the U.S. is set to lead a vigorous rebound in the West as mass vaccination against COVID-19 propels a return to more or less normal life. I think it's pretty normal life to me. Movie and a burger this weekend. Church, mass, every other pew is still roped off at my parish, but it's pretty open. My Presbyterian church remains restricted to 70 people, but that I think will change soon. So I couldn't get to that one. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I hope to make it back next week to our Presbyterian church. And in Europe, where the vaccination drives have been beset with hiccups, worries over side effects, the economies are taking a little bit longer, but it appears that they are going to welcome American citizens back to Europe this summer, which is good because they depend upon American tourism a lot of the places. I think of our twice canceled cruise from Paris to Normandy, which we now have scheduled for 2022. And of the guide I lined up 3 years ago, terrific guide. The only time I've been to Normandy, I had this guide. And he was a terrific guide. My friend Jan Genera found him. And I can't wait to find this fellow again. Hope he's still in the business 3 years later. The AstraZeneca virus has been cleared and is going everywhere. As you probably heard on Friday, the U.S., somewhat shamefacedly said, oh, yeah, Johnson & Johnson, fine. There have been 15 cases out of 8 million vaccines, three of which have been fatal, four more in the hospital, something like that. And in any event, it was silly to stop it. Only bureaucrats and government doctors who don't have any idea about how social media, they probably killed hundreds of thousands of people with that decision by increasing worry over Johnson & Johnson. But let's not tarry on the government doing stupid things, because that's kind of normal. Here it is. EU set to let vaccinated U.S. tourists visit this summer. All 27 member states will accept unconditionally all those who are vaccinated with vaccines that are approved by the EMA, said the head of the EU. The bloc's regulators have improved all three vaccines being used in the U.S., including Johnson & Johnson. So you can go to Europe if you had planned. I don't know what's going to be open. Alarmingly, millions are skipping their second doses of the COVID vaccine. About 8% of people. Now, we do have a knucklehead factor here. And we got to figure that this is particularly concentrated around Pittsburgh. But go get your second dose. It makes you feel a little bit bleh for a day, and then you're fine. When I got my second dose, I just took a nap for a day. You get a little bit of chills, but it's not even full-on flu. And so don't skip your second dose. They managed to find a few knuckleheads who said, well, I've got one, so that must be good enough. No, it's really intended to work with two. So not Johnson & Johnson. Johnson & Johnson's a one-shot wonder. Meanwhile, in Iraq, 82 people died in a fire in a hospital where COVID-19 patients were being killed. I suppose that will go onto the list of people who died with COVID as a contributing cause, but it's just a terrible tragedy when it's like ships. Hospitals, you can't move people. Fire at sea was always something that alarmed people that I knew that worked on it for a long time at the Pentagon, and fire at sea scares the heck out of everyone. They had protests all week at the Damascus Gate, and they got very, very violent. So Israel allowed protests there yet, and missiles flew. Third straight night of rocket attacks close to Gaza. Four were lightly hurt running for shelter. The United Arab Emirates criticized the Israeli response, but then the UAE and Israel struck a deal to sell a stake in the Tamar gas field for $1.1 billion. So the UAE is doing business even as they condemn Jewish extremist violence in Jerusalem, which, you know, Israel has their equivalent of the insurrectionists from January 6th, small group of people on the far, far right, and they're dealing with him. Oh, Mr. Zarif could be dead by the end of the day, I think, because Javad Zarif said the quiet part out loud, that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard pushes everyone around and they're in charge of the country. Restaurants are serving up bonuses, higher pay to win back workers, according to the Wall Street Journal. If you're a kid, there's no reason for you not to have a summer job because every restaurant in the world is hiring. U.S. restaurants can't get people to come back. Some people blame expanded unemployment. I don't know if that's the case. I just think that kids don't want to work. Go out to work, kids. Go to work on the restaurant. Everything from lumber to stocks to Bitcoin, according to the Wall Street Journal, in for a wild ride as prices set up for a bubble. Florida. Here's a rare negative Florida story. Florida real estate boom is crippled by the fact that insurers are flocking out of the state. Too many losses from hurricanes, etc. Same thing happened after earthquakes in California. They have to set up a special fund. And Americans give Biden's positive marks for his first 100 days, like 52%. So not really a great year for Donald Trump. When we come back, more coming up. That's the Rundown, America. Stay tuned to this Monday morning edition. 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. If you're one of the people that watch the Oscars, call me. Welcome back, America, on this Monday, April the 26th, in the year of our Lord, 2021. Joe Biden has a 52% approval rating, the lowest in modern times other than Donald Trump. And wondering what you think about that. Greg in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. The 100 days are almost upon us. We've got a presidential address on Wednesday night. Greg, what do you think?
Good morning, Mr. Hewitt. How are you today? I think they must be calling ostriches, because anybody who has any sense of what's coming out of Washington, D.C. right now has no idea what's going on if they're approving of anything that Joe Biden is doing.
Well, you know, he gave $30 billion, for example, to college students who were struggling. I read a story about this weekend. So if you were a college student who was living on credit cards and, you know, some of them had jobs, some didn't. I read it. So they got $1,000 checks stroked by, of course, they didn't send it to them directly. They sent it to the colleges that then had another system for deciding who got it. But they pumped $30 billion into college students. So those students are pretty happy. If you give them $600,000, $1,500, they're pretty happy. They're approving. So I think it reflects whoever got a check from the $1.9
trillion. And what happens to the college students? Paid all their debts and have struggled half their lives to pay off their debt. What are they getting?
Well, they're getting a nice handshake. They don't get a gold watch. They get a pat on the back for being not particularly bright when it came to managing their student loan debt. If they'd waited long enough, they would have simply gotten some relief. But, you know, it's called moral hazard, Greg. Moral hazard. Where are you driving to, by the way, this morning?
I'm in Bethlehem, heading down to beautiful Bridgeport, New Jersey.
Well, that's a good run. How long is that going to take you?
Well, where I start way up in the north, up by Scranton, and it takes usually about 3 hours and 20 minutes.
Okay, you coming back tonight?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Today,
what are you driving?
I drive an 18-wheeler, and I work for a big water company. We make water, baby.
Well, have you checked under the valves? I always check under the valves before I do something like that.
Always got to check the hood.
Just stop.
Hey, Greg, are you an Eagles fan?
No, I am one of those weird hybrid ex-New Yorkers. I'm a big Phillies fan, suffering this weekend, but I'm also a long-suffering Jets fan.
You're a Jets fan? Do we have the Ted Lasso? Did you hear the Ted Lasso cut last week?
Yes, I did, and boy, oh boy, I laughed like hell.
You've replaced the Browns. You know, the Browns are contending for a Super Bowl, and for years that all the punchline jokes were Browns jokes. Now they're Jets jokes.
Yeah, really. Thank you very much. I appreciate that so much.
Okay, well, you should pick Justin Fields if you don't want to live forever in the cellar. You guys go through quarterbacks like I go through interns. Seriously.
Can at least make the playoffs.
Don't even get your hopes up, Greg. Don't, because the Phillies will break your heart, too. Hey, good to talk to you, my friend. 1-800-520-1234. Let's go hear what Joe Manchin had to say with Dan Abash this weekend. He was on with Dan Abash, and throwing water on the progs. We're very upset with him. Cut number two, telling Dana he's not going to blow up the Senate. Cut number three, Cut number three.
At all. The best politics is good government. I can't believe that people believe that if you just do it my way, and that'll give us the momentum to get through the next election. But when you do something that everyone tags on to, and I've seen good things happen, that people voted against it, took credit for it when they went back home. We won't give this system a chance to work. I am not going to be part of blowing up this Senate of ours, or basically this democracy of ours, or the republic that we have. If we have a 51-vote threshold in the Senate, the same as the House wasn't designed to be partisan. The House was designed to be hot as a firecracker. We were designed to cool it off. And that's the founding fathers. It was a brilliant, brilliant strategy they looked at. So why can't we try to make this work?
That, he's right. For a Democrat, that's a rare burst of constitutional literacy. The framers designed the House to be very responsive to public opinion 2-year elections and the Senate to go slow. Now, the framers did not include the filibuster, and Dana might have asked him, but, you know, the framers didn't include the filibuster. They included to slow you down by virtue of you having 6-year terms and indirect election. So you got rid of the indirect election, and the response would be, we got rid of the indirect election, and we are now directly elected, so the filibuster is in response to that. But, you know, it's not Jim Crow. It's not a filibuster. It's not thrown out of Jim Crow. There have been filibusters in representative bodies forever. And the question of blowing it up is an important one, and Joe Manchin's not going to do that. By the way, Josh Hawley is another United States senator who's pretty interesting. He's doing an Ask Me Anything event with at askahost.com. I did one of these earlier this year. It was great fun. It's a dozen to 20 people max, and you have a conversation with the senator, and take advantage of it. You got to go to askahost.com. He's got a brand new book coming out about big tech, and he'll talk about that. The Tyranny of Big Tech is Josh Hawley's new book. He'll talk about that, and he'll talk with you. Also want to remind you, Job Creator Network. The past year has been a rough one for the United States, especially for small businesses, especially for restaurants, especially for retail, especially for anyone at a street front sign when there isn't any street traffic. And they're just trying to crush them more by taking away the subchapter S and subchapter C status, the pass-through regulations that Donald Trump, they're trying to put back. A lot of the regulatory relief that Donald Trump did. It's time, if you are a small business person, to get out of the Chamber of Commerce, which has collapsed at the national level. It's an utter, it's a collapse. I've never seen an interest group collapse as completely as the Chamber of Commerce has. And get out of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which has, you know, 1,000 employees, 900 of whom send memos to each other, and join JCN. And that, by the way, is the website, joinjcn.com, joinjcn.com. Let's go back to Joe Manchin. He's also throwing cold water on gun control. Cut number 4.
Every time a bill comes out, it's far in scope. We've basically took a bill way back in 2013, myself and Pat Toomey, and we worked on it and had good bipartisan support. Then we lost it right in the last week. NRA was against it. But basically, we call it common gun sense. And now we have a group working together. You've got Chris Murphy doing a great job. Chris is looking for that balance.
And is that doable? Is that balance doable right now?
I sure think it is doable that we can find common guns. You have to understand, law-abiding gun owners aren't going to loan their guns or sell their guns to strangers. But we have so many loopholes in the system. Can't we just fix what's broken?
That's what a lot of people
Yay, Joe Manchin, that would be a lot of sense. Now, the cicadas are coming. Now, this is mostly an East Coast deal. It's a Virginia deal. I think they wake up in about 2 weeks, but there was a Washington Post piece on cicadas, which I want you to listen to, because if you live in the West and you're up early, you have no idea. If you've lived in the West your whole life, you have no idea what a nightmare this is. The cicada story, cut number 1.
Some people estimate this to be perhaps billions of cicadas. I'd be willing to wager that, hey, it could be even trillions of cicadas.
Ready or not, the cicadas are coming. After nearly 2 decades underground, 3 species of the Boruedex cicadas will emerge early this summer, and they're expected to hit the eastern United States hard.
The big tsunami is going to hit the last 2 weeks of May, if this year is anything like last year. And then by the middle of June, they will begin to tail off. And sadly, that will be the end of cicadas for 2021.
So that's Mike Raup, also known as the Bug Guy. He's a professor of entomology at the University of Maryland.
They're underground basically as immature stages for 17 years. And that is perhaps the longest live insect underground. And I suspect the males will be out first. This is fairly common in the insect world. You don't want to arrive late to the party, right? So the males are going to be out first. So they get to maybe strut their stuff a little bit sooner to impress the babes. After they mate, shortly after the males mate, they will die because, hey, they've done what they need to do. The females will live for a period of time, and during this time, they will actually be inserting their eggs in the young branches of trees.
So the cicadas are emerging in 15 states and in the District of Columbia, ranging from Georgia to New York State and west to the states bordering the Mississippi River.
Totally understand that some people are not going to understand cicadas. They can be fearful of cicadas, and I take that very seriously.
But still, there are a lot of misconceptions about cicadas and what their arrival means.
No, they don't bite. They don't have a chewing type mouth part, so they don't bite. Pets are going to love these things. Everything on the planet is going to want to eat a cicada when this comes out very shortly. So in addition to, you know, the squirrels, the birds, raccoons and skunks and foxes, yeah, your pets are going to want cicadas. They're high quality protein. And certainly humans will eat cicadas. I will be eating cicadas.
Raup recommends not trying to disturb them. They really want nothing to do with us, but they might keep us up at night.
We're not recommending people use bug spray. Cicadas will not be attracted to humans. All they really want to do is they want to get up in the treetops. The males will be singing their hearts out. It will be a big boy band. They're clumsy flyers, and if you are in between, let's say where a cicada emerges and the big party up in the treetops, these kind of clumsy flyers may bump into you. They may land on you for a minute. They are not attacking you.
The males. Cicadas are coming, and I have a cicada producer. Dwayne comes in every 17 years. Now, I was in D.C. when they came up in 1987, and it's a racket. I was not here in 2004 when they came back, but I'm back in 2021 when they're back. I wasn't here in 1970. It's a 17-year deal. It's like Dwayne.
What do you mean humans eat them? No, they don't.
Some do. You know, some humans eat everything. I don't know. If you're telling me that this is your cicada year and you're showing up, I'm glad to hear it. I think you are on a cicada ribbon, and you do come in every 17 years, and we're glad to have you back. But don't step on the bit. The bit is that they're mostly the noisiest thing you've ever heard. Every night for about 2 weeks in May and then 2 weeks in June, it's just like planes from National are landing over you. And then the party doesn't tell you about, they die, and they're everywhere. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Selena Zito is here for the Yinzer Report. She's written a couple of grand columns, one on Daniel Cameron, the new Attorney General of Kentucky, but one that came out today in the Washington Examiner on the brutalism movement of the urban planners of the 50s and 60s, and it did a number on Pittsburgh. Now, I'm not sure I've got a lot of sympathy for Pittsburgh ever, Selena, but the East Valley Freeway and the Lower Hill neighborhood where you put the Civic Arena, those urban planners of the 50s and 60s were not particularly gifted people, were they?
Oh, absolutely not. And I could read off a bunch of other neighborhoods, too. All of the very culturally rich neighborhoods with a variety of different immigrant settlements in them. And because they didn't have much political capital, they were expendable, disposable. And so they weren't able to fight the fight or, you know, have the right muscle to be able to save their communities. And so these beautiful neighborhoods, you know, and beautiful in the sense that there was so much rich history in them and so much different multiculturalism that made them so unique, were just bulldozed for these, sometimes, most of the time, for highways that connected cities to suburbs and made the commute faster. The city fathers used to argue, oh, well, that's for them to come into the city, you know, faster so they can come back and have drinks after work. Well, that wasn't the trend in the 80s and 90s. The trend was to get out of the cities as fast as possible. And that's what those highways allowed.
Yeah, I've got to give it to the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. They did one smart thing, which is they plopped Dulles Airport like a million miles beyond anybody back in the day. Now, of course, it's surrounded by development. And there was never any good reason to plow through cities, because if you built it out in the hinterlands, the city would follow the roads and the businesses would follow the roads. I am curious about the picture of St. Boniface. Have you been inside that church? It looks like a sturdy old church.
Yeah, both of my kids. So that's not far from where I grew up. It wasn't my parish, But as you know, in those Midwest and Appalachian cities, there was a parish on every corner, right?
Yep.
But both of my kids were confirmed there. It was very traditional German neighborhood that they annihilated. Currently, as these parishes have been lumped together, this one has still withstood the West test of time, and it hasn't been eliminated. But now it exclusively does Latin masses.
Well, good for St. Boniface. Now, tell us a little bit about Daniel Cameron. I greatly enjoyed your column on him. It took a while for anybody to get to interview him. Did you tell him he's got to raise his media profile a little bit, up the game?
Well, that wasn't my objective. I really wanted to get in there and talk to him. First of all, because I find him such an intriguing figure. He is the epitome of the happy warrior, right? No matter how serious the subject is, he does it with grace, and most of the time he does it with a smile. And that's something that is almost all the time missed in today's sort of attitudes in politics. He's also very accomplished for someone who's only been in office for over a year. But I went down to Frankfurt and sat in the office with him for well over an hour. And he's an impressive young man, and I predict that this is a young man that's going places.
Well, he's going to replace Mitch McConnell, I think, whenever Mitch retires. He is the first statewide Republican elected to the office of Attorney General, the first African-American Republican, or maybe African-American, period, elected in the state
period.
Of Kentucky. Period. Okay, so he's a real comer. He also took on the Breonna Taylor case. He doesn't shirk away from difficult cases. Your column really conveyed that very well, but he doesn't do much media. How did you finally connect up with him?
I'm annoying.
Well, that does work.
I'm nice but annoying, and after a while, that eventually they say, well, okay, if you stop calling us, we'll give you the interview.
We'll give you an hour. Well, and then they read it and they say, well, you know, I should be doing more of this. And I met with a couple of people over the weekend about candidates who are a little bit media shy one way or the other. And you do have to repeatedly tell them you're not. It's because so many people like Politico are just out to screw people. And most of us in the business are not out to screw people, but to tell stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, if you're a Republican, you don't want to talk to Politico because they're there to screw you. But if you're just Selena Zito or Hugh Hewitt, we're not here to screw you. Left, right, or center, we're here to tell your story. Selena, great two columns. All columns by Selena are available at selenazito.com. Sign up for them. They will be sent into your mailbox, your inbox, and they're wonderful, whether they're in the New York Post, the Washington Examiner, the Wall Street Journal, or wherever Selena writes. Have a great Monday, Selena. I'll be right back. Hour number two of the Hugh Hewitt Show, straight ahead. Morning, Glory America. It's Hugh Hewitt on this Monday, April 26th, joined as I am most Mondays by Jake Sherman, editor-in-chief of Punch Bowl News. If you go to punchbowlnews.com and just sign up, they send you the best newsletter in town every single morning. And, Jake, I don't know if you're up in Hershey, Pennsylvania, enjoying beautiful Pennsylvania weather. Are you with the Republicans as they caucus at their retreat?
I am, but it's in Orlando, Florida, so I'm in Orlando.
Oh, I thought it was in Hershey. I was wondering why they went to Hershey. Thank God they went to Orlando. I was about to say, what in the world were they doing in Hershey?
We are in Orlando, Florida.
All right. I've done that retreat a couple of times. It's usually pretty fun. They always run with the slides from the pollsters at the end. And this pollster has come up with the amazing insight that Nancy Pelosi is the least popular politician in America. I mean, that's breakthrough stuff right there, Jake.
Yeah, you know, they've been saying this since about 2004.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's been true since 2004, but as my colleague John Bresnahan put in this morning, she's won the majority twice in that time period. So, yes, unpopular, but also quite prolific when it comes to politics, I'd say.
Yeah, but did they talk at all about redistricting? What I really would have liked to have heard this year is they don't have the numbers yet, so they can't figure out who gets what. But have they talked about the redistricting processes and what their built-in advantage is? It's sort of like being the home team in baseball. If you're in the American League and you are, you've got the DH, and if you're in the National League and you don't have the DH, and you're at home in the National League for this World Series, you got to make the pitchers bat, and the poor American League pitchers look so bad. We're going to have a home field advantage, we being Republicans. Did they talk about that at all?
Well, today they're going to get a presentation from Tom Emmer, the chair of the NRCC, and Dan Constan, the head of the Republican Super PAC, where I imagine that it's going to be a top topic of conversation, so to speak. But yes, I think they will talk about that. And they're going to talk about the fact, I mean, listen, there's a story in the New York Times today by Mark Leibovich about Kevin McCarthy, where he notes pretty prominently that McCarthy only needs 5 seats to become speaker. So the advantage is clearly there.
Yeah. Now, I believe that story is interesting because Kevin, who I've known forever, is a very good leader, sometimes not as good on TV as he is off TV. But everybody likes Kevin. And he's going to win the speakership because Jim Jordan is over at Judiciary and having fun. I am curious what they're going to do about incumbents like Anthony Gonzalez, who I will be all for. He's an Ohio State man. He's a receiver. He represents Rocky River. But he's running against a Trump alum named Max Miller, who's from the east side of Cleveland, which is where the money is, and he's running against a west sider, Anthony Gonzalez, who's Cuban-American, and a Buckeye. I mean, he wore the scarlet and gray for Jim Tressel back in the day and played pro football. Much buzzing about whether or not the NRCC is going to get involved with races like that one?
The NRCC needs to get involved in races like that, and I say needs to from a ethical and moral point of view, but also from a member management point of view. I mean, people pay dues into the NRCC, so they get incumbents back when they need it. I mean, that's the long and short of it, Hugh. And if they don't, there's going to be blowback. Gonzalez is a popular member. He has gotten on the wrong side of Trump. He doesn't like Trump. He doesn't think he's, you know, we all know the story about that, but that doesn't mean he's not a Republican and a sitting Republican at that. So I would say they need to get on his side.
Yeah, Liz Cheney and Gonzalez, they're both going to win, and they're going to win fairly easily. And I don't actually expect the former president to get involved because he doesn't like losing. And they're going to look at the numbers for Anthony Gonzalez, who could be governor if he wants to be governor, and he could have run for Senate if he wanted, but he likes being a congressman for a while. He's going to wait around until Sherrod Brown steps down, I think, and go for it. And he didn't want any part of this 8-way Republican nightmare. Steve Stivers dropped out. Were you surprised by that, Jake Sherman? He's not running for Senate.
I was surprised by that a little bit because I thought Stivers, and we made the case in Punch Bowl News for this, made the case based on reporting that he thought there would be a mess of Trump aligned Republicans who would be basically eat at each other, and he thought he could slide in on the other side of that.
Well, it's Jane Timken and Josh Mandel and J.D. Vance and Stivers, and he dropped out. And now I when it was going to be 5 guys and a gal, I thought the last man standing might be a woman. Now I don't really know. J.D. Vance got $10 million banked by Peter Thiel in a super PAC. He's got a story. He's a Marine. Josh Mandel's been nominated before. He's a Marine. He's got a story. Jane Timken knows everybody in Ohio. It's a fascinating race. Any buzz about that around Orlando?
Not really. It's mostly House stuff. But listen, Stivers is well liked. He's going to go back and run the Chamber of Commerce in Ohio, which is a position he's kind of uniquely suited for, frankly. A position that he will make some money in. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see him in politics again.
You know what's interesting about chambers? Danny Seiden just got elected chamber president in Arizona, which is a state with a dysfunctional GOP structure. And now we've got Stivers taking over the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. I think they may become replacements for dysfunctional parties. Unlike the National Chamber, which is in collapse and in ruins, the building is still burning and all the Republicans have fled and they won't talk to anyone from the chamber. The state chambers are still well respected on a general basis. Look, I want to talk about the last of the Dean Martin Republicans, John Boehner. You sat down with him last night. And his book is plummeting. It's now down to 70 on Amazon. He had his 1 week in the sun. I took a look at the endorsements on the book, and I find this to be the funniest set of endorsements ever. Do you know who blurbs his book?
I don't. Who did it?
Oh, my gosh. Look, we got some of the usual suspects. We got Jake Tapper and Steve Inskeep from CNN NPR, not exactly on the Republican brand. But then we've got Stephen Colbert and we've got Whoopi Goldberg. But my absolute favorite endorsement is Nancy Sinatra. Boehner finally calls it as he sees it. Nancy Sinatra? Jake Sherman, what is it, the 1950s?
You know, I couldn't speak to that, but he was really entertaining. I mean, remember, he was a number one bestseller. As you know, you've written books. That takes a lot. That's a big deal.
It takes a lot of pre-sale to your buddies and bulk sales to your friends. And yeah, it, number one bestseller, I get it. I've only been on the list twice. I never got to number one, so I know what it means. But I also know what it means when you fall off the hill, and that means they built it into the pre-sales and bulk sales to your buddies. But I got to ask you about Boehner when he said that. What else is all he does is trash Republicans.
No, he talked about his, I mean, that's not totally true, Hugh. I mean, he talks about his relationship with Jerry Ford. He talks about his relationship in the House. He talks about, I mean, he has a lot of interesting stories. I don't know if you've had him on the show, but I thought he had a lot of interesting stories in this book. I enjoyed it.
Now, they asked, and I said no for a simple reason, Jake. When he was running for speaker, he lived on this show. Before he was speaker, when he wanted to be majority leader, when he was rising, he would come on this show weekly. As soon as he became speaker, we couldn't get him to call us back. And that's who John Boehner is. And that's why that's who he is. Can I use you? I can use Jake to sell books. So I'll sell books with Jake for a while. And then he'll be off selling dope somewhere. Did you ask him about his dope deal?
I did not, no. But I thought about it. I forgot about it in the moment.
Okay. Now, so McCarthy versus Boehner and McCarthy versus Ryan. Ryan will always have the affection of serious people. John Boehner's not a serious man. Paul Ryan's a serious man. I think Kevin McCarthy is a hybrid between the two. He knows his policy and he knows how to schmooze. What do you think?
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, Kevin is certainly not a policy person like Paul is and never will be, but he definitely has a better political acumen than probably either man. And I think Boehner and Ryan did both look to Kevin for political advice when they were in power. And that's a good point. Kevin has a chunk of both of them. I think that's fair to say.
And he knows his caucus. Boy, does he know his caucus. So does Steve Scalise. I kind of like the leadership. Tom Emmer and I and Rona and Rick Scott are doing a roundtable. I'm the imported journalist to do a roundtable at the Republican Senate retreat to ask them about that. Has Emmer done his prediction yet as he sat down and walked through the numbers?
He has not, but he's speaking today. But I think, no, he has not given the prediction. I think besides saying that he thinks that they're going to win the majority.
Now, there's a term in securities law called open kimono. And sometimes the Republican retreats are open kimono where you get to go to every meeting and hear every presentation. Is that the situation, Jake, in Orlando?
Not for me, but it will be for Republicans. We don't get to go to anything. We sit in the media center
what?
And come in and brief us. Yeah, I know it's bad.
What? That doesn't make any sense.
I know.
Everyone's got a cell phone on and they're taping everything. Honest to goodness.
I agree.
You know, I do not understand why they don't go on the record, because all of these things are taped by everyone and everything's on the record, even though they don't say so. Jake, it's a great newsletter this morning. Last quick question. It says the economy favors the Republicans. Do you agree with that?
I think it's early, right? I mean, it probably doesn't
yep.
point, but I think it's very early.
That's what I think. I don't think they ought to be taking that to the bank. Jake Sherman, Punch Bowl News. Go and subscribe to it, punchbowlnews.com. He's not a Dean Martin Republican. He just talks to him. He talks to everybody. Stay tuned, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. But all of it brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that 3-week starter pack, $19.95. Welcome. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by one of our favorite guests, Keith Kroc. He was Undersecretary for Energy and the Economy under Mike Pompeo at State and President Trump. He's back in D.C., did a sit-down with another of our favorite guests, General Stanley McChrystal, over for The Washington Post, and he's in town for a bit. Keith Kroc, welcome back to The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hugh, it's so great to be back with you. You know, the only thing that could be better, maybe we're in Cleveland. I don't know.
That would be better. Now, Keith, I want to know, did you leave town? Did you go back to California? Because the Post ran a story this weekend on how the exodus from California really isn't that bad. And I thought, well, maybe they're counting Keith Kroc going back to the Silicon Valley. As the founder of DocuSign, did you go home again or did you stay on the Beltway?
No, I did, Hugh. I went back with my family. You know, I had seen but a few days over the last year, so it was great to be back home. And then it's also great to be back in Washington.
All right. Now, talk to me a little bit about sitting down with General McChrystal. Like I said, he's been in my studio, both East Coast and West Coast. One of the people I admire the most, his books, Team of Teams, Leaders, and his memoir. They're just amazing books. He's an amazing person. What did you and the Post, you and he talk about to the Post?
Well, we talked about technology security and how critical that is to national security. We also talked about energy security. And Stan is a friend. He was on our DocuSign advisory board. He's one of the most courageous men I've ever met. And what he's doing now in the private sector, he's applying those military analogies and those leadership principles and really coaching and training companies. So it was a great fireside chat.
One of the things that struck me about the appropriateness of you two being paired up, when General McChrystal came out with Team of Teams, he revealed that when he was head of special operations for 3 years, he had a daily joint meeting with 7,000 people under his command by secure video. And I talked to him at length, and this is over at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, if people want to go and listen to Stan McChrystal, about the security challenges. And he said, well, the network was clean, which, of course, reminded me of Keith Kroc and your clean network initiative. Has Team Biden kept the clean network initiative going?
By the way, it's right in their wheelhouse, the Clean Network Alliance of Democracies. And it's something that this administration really believes in. And that is the power of an alliance of democracies, leveraging innovation and resource of the private sector, and also amplifying the democratic values in that moral high ground. So far, I really think they see this as a winning formula. And what we were able to do with the Clean Network really created a model that has that's battle-hardened. It's been tested. And as you know, Hugh, it defeated the Chinese Communist Party's master plan for 5G and exposed their biggest weakness, and that's lack of trust.
Now, the Wall Street Journal today has a story on Australia and the fact that their foreign minister vetoed a couple of deals that China, the Chinese Communist Party, wanted to conclude with Victoria, one of their the equivalent of an American state, sort of like if China wanted to do a deal with New York State. And the foreign minister stepped in and vetoed them, afraid of the China influence on their networks. What did you make of the Australian move, and do we need more of that?
Well, we certainly do. And I'll tell you, what I learned in the government after so many bilateral meetings with my foreign counterparts is not only does countries don't trust them, but they, you know, the elephant in the room is their intimidation, retaliation, and retribution. And I think that's one of the powers of the Clean Network is that it creates a security blanket against that retaliation because there's strength in numbers and there's power and unity in those numbers. So it's a really, really important concept.
Now, I'm talking with former Undersecretary for the Economy and Energy, Keith Kroc. Mr. Wang Yi, who is one of China's top diplomats, said in The New York Times this morning that Chinese cooperation on climate, this came after the most boring climate summit ever, Chinese cooperation would depend on how the United States responded to Beijing's policies regarding Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Xinjiang province. How do you translate that, Keith Kroc?
Well, by the way, we do not let them tie those things together. Of course, they want to do that. That is a classic strategy. And they're motivated to move ahead in clean energy, because one of the inconvenient truths about the inconvenient truth is that there's solar panels, which is industry experts say that'll be 50 to 60% of the energy in the year 2050. They're made in Xinjiang. They're made with slave labor, and they're made with their big coal-fired power plants where they have their big coal mines in Xinjiang.
So it's got to be turned down flat. And I didn't see that coming out of Secretary Blinken or President Biden. It's just got to be they cannot link those issues.
They cannot link those issues. And, you know, the only way to deal with the Chinese Communist Party, I think we've learned this, is from strength. And even though they talk about win-win, it's a zero-sum game for them. And if we're going to cooperate with them, we've got to compete with them first and come from a source of strength.
Now, let me ask you about Taiwan. You were one of two senior American representatives, the other being Secretary of Health and Human Services Azar, who were dispatched to the island state of Taiwan during the Trump administration. Now, 3 weeks ago, your old boss, Mike Pompeo, sat down with Taiwan's special representative of the United States, signaling, I think, the direction of the Republican Party, which is towards a bear hug of Taiwan and a recommitment to their defense. What did you make of the meeting between Secretary Pompeo and the special representative? What did you learn when you were on Taiwan? I've never visited that island, by the way. I've never been there, so I have no idea really what it feels like. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, they are one of the role models of capitalism and democracy in the region. Matter of fact, around the world. And I had been doing a lot of business in Taiwan in my business career. They are wonderful people. They are great friends to Americans. And they are courageous. And they're absolutely strategic. And one of the big things that we did about a year ago is we onshored TSMC, perhaps the most important company to United States national security. That's in the semiconductor.
Taiwan Semiconductor.
Correct. Yeah. So and one of the things when I went over there for President Lee's memorial service is we put in place an economic prosperity partnership where we partnered in all areas of economic collaboration. And then about a month later, we signed a science and technology agreement, and hopefully leading up to a TIFA, which is a step to a free trade agreement. Because what we want to do is we want to drive private sector investment in Taiwan, and we want our allies to do it there. So we're all committed.
Now tell me a little bit about what you think of strategic ambiguity. That has been the name given to the U.S. Chinese Communist Party Taiwan dance since President Nixon made his visit in 1972. Two systems, one China. And that's a nice way to gloss over the fact that if unification were ever to occur, it was to have been done on peaceful terms. It doesn't look like it's ever going to occur. And the Chinese Communist Party is becoming impatient. What do you think about, is it time to jettison strategic ambiguity, Keith Kroc, and just say we will defend Taiwan against aggression?
Well, I think I've got to leave that up to the Pentagon. But I do know this, that there are two ways for the Chinese Communist Party to take over Taiwan. One is through their elections. And, you know, just a few years ago, we were really concerned about that. And that's why things like the free trade agreement and our partnership with them is so key for their political process. And it's also key in defending them, because we need our allies in terms of if some type of kinetic action takes place.
So, Keith Kroc, let me go back to what you're doing now. There are like three center-right people in all of Silicon Valley. Peter Thiel has left, and the other one is a big friend of Mike Pompeo's who I've met, and there's you, and you're another friend of Pompeo. What is Silicon Valley waking up to the fact the Democratic Party is not their friends? Do you look at the new FTC nominee, and they're coming for him? Do they know that yet?
I'm not really sure about that, but I can tell you one thing where they do know. They know that not only is the Chinese Communist Party a real and urgent threat to democracy, but it's a real and urgent threat to their companies, because they just don't want to compete. They want to put them out of business. And I brought Secretary Pompeo out to Silicon Valley for about 4 days last year, so he could hear it up front and close. And, you know, obviously the battleground is the technology front. Also a key part of it is capital markets as well, because even though we're putting export restrictions on them, Hugh, we're financing them. And that's something that really needs to be addressed. I think we went a long way in terms of the Pentagon list. We listed 1,100 Chinese companies that need to be divested, but there's a lot more that can be done.
Okay, last question. Okay. What are you doing? I mean, you just can't sit around and look out your window at beautiful vistas. You've got, I know you too well, and I don't know you that well, but you're not a man who sits around much. What are you doing?
Well, you're right, Hugh. I mean, I tried retirement before. It's really overrated. You know, for me, I'm continuing in this fight. And the opportunity I had to serve the country and being blessed with the American dream, I will continue to do that. And it will be focused on securing our technologies and countering China's economic aggression, because I think this is the biggest existential threat of our lifetime. And, you know, so it's all about leaving the world a better place for our grandchildren and our great grandchildren. So I'm not giving up on that. And I think there's a lot of things I can do to from the private sector standpoint, because we need the private sector in this fight.
Well, there's a lot of things you could do on the public side as well. California's going to have a recall. Are we going to see Keith Kroc's name on that long list of people to replace Gavin Newsom?
Well, man, you always ask me that question. I don't think this time, you, but I really appreciate it.
I think you ought to study this. That list, I know it's got Caitlyn Jenner on it. I don't think Rick Grenell's going to go. I don't know. About, no one tells me anything, but I think a big tech, high tech, former senior Trump official who actually knows something about technology would fare pretty well, Keith Kroc.
Well, I think if you're my campaign manager, there's no way I can lose you.
Well, I'm not leaving D.C., so okay. We're going to have to find you another campaign manager. Keith Kroc, good to talk to you. Great to come back whenever you're in town and chat with me. I cannot wait to watch that McChrystal Kroc conversation. It's over at the Washington Post, and I'm looking forward to hearing what two of my favorite guests had to say to each other. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you, Hugh. God bless you.
Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt on Monday, April 26th. In 2 weeks, on Saturday, May the 8th, Virginia is going to nominate a Republican to take on Terry McAuliffe in the fall race for governor. The state house, the Republicans really need to win that. That's why I'm going to be voting as a delegate for Glenn Youngkin, who joins me now via Skype. Hello, Glenn. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. How are you? Thanks for having me again.
I'm great. I'm glad to have you, and we'll have you next Monday as well, and Friday before, to remind everyone about the distributed convention. I see you were in Charlottesville. How does Charlottesville feel? That's kind of a blue part of the state, isn't it?
Yeah, we have absolutely been all over Virginia. We've traveled 19,000 miles in about 13 weeks, and all across Virginia, I'm hearing the same thing, Hugh, is we cannot afford another term of the McAuliffe-Northam administration. So even areas that have traditionally been pretty blue, I'm seeing big turnouts at events and a very strong sense that we're going to win this thing in November.
Now, it's a distributed convention, so I want people to know the rules. We've done this before, but this is the first time we've done it in this segment. I'm all across Virginia. Explain to them how it works, Glenn Youngkin.
Yeah, there's going to be about 40 polling locations across Virginia. You can actually come to our website at youngkinforgovernor.com and find out where they're going to be. You'll drive up. You'll actually get your ballot. It'll be a rank-ordered choice ballot. Fill in your ballot. I'd ask all the listeners to please consider putting me as your first choice. You'll actually vote for a governor, a lieutenant governor, an attorney general. You'll drop off your ballot. You'll head away. And we'll win this on May 8th and then get moving to go beat Terry McAuliffe in the general.
Now, this is not your message. It's Hugh Hewitt's message. I believe in when you have multi-ranked candidates, I only vote for the person I want to win. Because if they don't win, I don't really get excited too much. So I'm just going to vote for Glenn Youngkin, as is the fetching Mrs. Hewitt, and not pick a second choice. I don't know what your polling shows about that. I don't even know if you can poll a distributed convention. Can you, Glenn Youngkin?
Well, Hugh, we've been, of course, speaking to all the delegates. We've registered nearly 18,000 delegates who came through our campaign to participate in this. Just to put it in context, when they were going to have an assembled convention in Lynchburg, they were hoping 5,000 people would attend. We've had two really great governor's forums, both at Liberty University and last night, the Faith and Freedom debate. And I won both straw polls. And so it feels really good, Hugh, the momentum we have going into May the 8th. And I just look forward to winning on May the 8th and heading on and beating Terry McAuliffe.
Now, this is going to be a turnout operation. I want to come back to the two forums in just a second. But it's going to be a turnout operation where Team Youngkin has to reach out and remind people on May the 8th. Are you geared up for that?
We've absolutely been in contact and making sure that everybody shows up. Get out the vote is hugely important. But, Hugh, we've been running a different kind of campaign from the beginning. The Republicans in Virginia for the last 10-plus years have really mastered the art of losing the statewide elections. This is why I quit my job last summer and jumped into this race, because, one, I love Virginia. I am so upset with where Virginia is. And second of all, I felt the Republican Party in Virginia really wasn't doing the things we needed to do to win. We're going to win this by addition and multiplication, not by subtraction and division. And so we've been growing participation. There will be more people involved in this convention than any convention in the history of Virginia. And that just represents the huge efforts that our campaign has put forth to get people involved, get them out to the polls, and yes, to put Glenn Youngkin down as their first choice.
All right, now let's talk about both the Liberty University Forum and the one last night. What were the settings? Who showed up? How did it go? What were the key questions?
Yeah. Hugh, the one at Liberty and the one last night were actually open forums for everybody to participate. I've participated in all of them. Some of the other candidates have selectively chosen not to show up. I guess the big question is, will they show up if they wanted to run for governor? Well, I'm showing up everywhere, Hugh, and I've won both of them in the straw poll. The issues that are being talked about are real. How do we get this economy open and running, and who's most qualified to do that? And I felt that my business career is second to none to create jobs and get this economy moving. But Hugh, one of the biggest topics that I'm talking about is education. And by the way, with Democrat leadership, we have our schools closed, we're canceling Dr. Seuss, and now we're deciding not to teach accelerated math through the 11th grade and not to award advanced diplomas to high schoolers that can run. We are absolutely taking Virginia kids out of the fast lane and putting them in the broken down lane. And as governor, I will not let this happen. If this superintendent of a state superintendent Lane is still there when I get there, I'm firing him on the spot, and we're going to allow Virginia's kids to run as fast as they can. My goodness, I've never heard anything so silly in my life, that we're going to hold students back as opposed to letting them run as fast as they can.
You anticipated my next question. I took both of my boys are Virginians, and I took them out to lunch and a movie on Saturday. And I asked them if they remembered a kid from the fourth grade way back in their California elementary years named Dylan. I won't give you the last name, who was taking high school math classes at University High School, which is among the top 10 high schools in all of California in the fourth grade. They said, and they both knew his name and they both knew he was a genius. And we laughed about how for some people, math is like a picture that they see. And I cannot believe Virginia announced over the weekend that there isn't going to be math for anyone until 11th grade. They can't accelerate. That is really kind of the stupidest thing I've ever heard an educator say.
Yeah, Hugh, I thought I had fallen down the rabbit hole and was in Wonderland when I read this. And I immediately called for everyone's resignation at the Board of Education and our state superintendent to actually hold Virginia's kids back, to say, no, you can't be the best you can be. You have to go to another state to do that, because we're going to actually mandate equal outcomes in Virginia as opposed to equal opportunities. What craziness. When I'm governor, these children are going to be able to run as fast as they possibly can. Yes, we're going to have opportunities for all. But this is un-American. This is about American exceptionalism and our ability to be the best that we can possibly be. And the Democrats in Virginia, led by Terry McAuliffe and Ralph Northam, simply don't believe that. And that's why I'm running for governor. And that's why we're going to win back Virginia and put her back where she belongs, as the best state in America to live and work and raise a family.
Did this math issue come up at any of the forums, Glenn Youngkin?
Yeah, it came up last night big time. And I will tell you, the Virginians, the big group of Virginians that were there, are absolutely beside themselves. You listen to parents, and parents are saying, my goodness, Our schools are still partially or fully closed to the tune of 70% across Virginia. We're canceling out Dr. Seuss. We're not going to award advanced diplomas to kids that excel past the high school curriculum. We're not going to allow children to, in fact, take accelerated math classes. I mean, this is education gone awry. This has gone amok. The first thing I'm going to do is, after I change out our state superintendent and our state board of education, is we're going to press forward with school choice so that parents have the opportunity to move into charter schools or take their tuition dollars and actually find the best school for their child. A child's destiny should not be dictated by his or her zip code. And as governor, I'm going to make sure that Virginia is number one in education.
You know, Democrats right now control both houses of the Virginia legislature. That may change. Redistricting is happening. But I don't think that's a partisan issue. I think education is a bipartisan issue and excellence and opportunity for everyone, because math genius comes in all sizes, shapes, and colors. It's been my experience for a long time that you can never tell who's going to be the math genius.
No, and it is not a partisan issue. I've spoken to, yes, Republicans all over Virginia as I've traveled 19,000 miles in 13 weeks, but also independents and Democrats. And this is a family issue. This is a Virginia kid issue. And there is not a single person I have spoken to who suggests that they want their kids held back. This is craziness. So, yes, Hugh, I think the Democrats have absolutely shown their stripes here. They're not for American exceptionalism. They're absolutely for mandating modest outcomes for Virginia so that they can, in fact, dictate how we live our lives, have big government, and control us. And this is not what a Youngkin administration is going to be about. We are going to open up Virginia day one. We're going to open our businesses. We're going to open our schools. We're going to open our houses of worship. And we're going to get Virginia going to become the great state that it should be, has been, and will be again.
Okay, Saturday, May 8th. There will be 40 places, and they can find those places at youngkinforgovernor.com. Did I summarize that correctly?
Perfectly, yes. Youngkin, youngkinforgovernor.com. Visit our website. Find out where to go vote. You can vote between 9 and 4. And by the way, Hugh, originally our state central was going to restrict folks who had a religious exemption, and I pushed back hard. And last night, in fact, they changed their minds, and they opened up the polls on Friday night, so that those folks that actually observe the Sabbath on Saturday could, in fact, vote on Friday. And I just think this is a big statement. We are the party of religious freedom. We are the party of election integrity. And to allow people to vote on Friday night who can't otherwise make it on Saturday was a great reversal from what was a bad decision from State Central last week.
Good for you, Glenn Youngkin. I saw you leading on that and on math. YoungkinForGovernor.com. We'll talk to you next week, Glenn, and congratulations on running a great race thus far. We'll talk again next Monday, and then we'll be voting a week from Saturday on May 8th to nominate a winner in the Commonwealth, because we need to win that state house. Stay tuned, America. It's the UU Show.
Well, look at me. I'm coming back again. I got a taste of love in a simple way, and if you need to know while I'm still standing, you just fade away. Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever
did. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined by New York Times columnist, PBS contributor David Brooks. Hi, David. How are you?
Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. I always enjoy talking with you. I usually agree with what you write, but I really don't agree with your most recent column, so I'm looking forward to this. David, I want to first, for my GPS on you, after mid-December, I went to California, and I stayed there until April, because who doesn't want to be in Southern California as opposed to the Beltway for the first 3 months of the year? And so I have been out of the vortex, and therefore I have just a very different view of what Republicans think. Did you stay in town for those 3 months?
No, I'm actually out here in rural Maryland, and I'm pretty Trump carried the county I'm in. So we got a mixture of people out here.
No, well, the reason I think that your column, which is quite alarming about the state of the Republican Party, it's just not what I saw. At one point, you write, since the election, large swaths of the Trumpian right have decided America is facing a crisis like never before. And they are the small army of warriors fighting with Alamo-level desperation to ensure the survival of the country as they conceive it. Actually, what I saw is a bunch of people who, you know, kind of moaning about the tax increases that are coming. They don't think Joe Manchin's going to flip. They're not worried about the Supreme Court expanding. And they're basically settled in for the first honeymoon, because the honeymoon's the honeymoon. Where did you get this data?
Well, there is data. So, you know, there was a one poll where they asked people, do you think politics is about policies, or is it about the survival of the country? And Democrats think it's mostly about policies, but 51% of Trump voters said it's about the survival of the country, and only 19% care about policy, which is why I think the Republicans are doing a pretty bad job of pushing back against Joe Biden's infrastructure and jobs plan. The second piece of data is they asked Americans, which of these two statements do you agree with? The first statement is, it's a big, beautiful world. People are basically good. We should try to get along. The second statement was, our lives are threatened by terrorists, criminals, and illegal immigrants. And 75% of Biden voters supported the big, beautiful world statement. 66% of Trump voters supported our lives are threatened. And so I find people like you describe, but I also find people who think the country is facing an existential crisis. I think they're, frankly, overreacting. I don't think we are. But that's a reasonably common view. And the final thing I'll say is, you know, among my Republican friends, a lot of them, they're facing more conflict in their churches and in their families than they did even during the Trump administration. So that's just some of the vibe I get, you know, just from talking to my friends.
Okay, now I will contrast that with my friends. And I go to both the Presbyterian Church and the Roman Catholic Church. I go to Mass on Saturday night. I go to the Presbyterian Church on Sunday. I've seen none of that. I've seen people on patios at Easter who are happy to see people they haven't seen in a long time. The Catholic Church has stopped a lot of the stuff I don't like anyway, like the sung responsorial psalm, and we don't shake hands anymore. So I'm really happy with my Catholic churches. But one of the things I did, David, in California was to convene the Nixon seminar. I'm not a member of it, but it's led by Pompeo and O'Brien, and it includes Jonathan Burks, Alex Gray, Kimberly Reed, Lonnie Chen, Mary Kissel, Nadia Shadlow, Chris Cox, John Noonan, Congressman Michael Waltz, Monica Crowley, Morgan Ortegas, Christian Witten, Congressman Mike Gallagher, Matt Pottinger, Alex Wong. 15 people under 50. Now, the chairman, Pompeo and O'Brien, are older than that, but 15 people under 50. They're very upbeat on America if we take China seriously. They just don't care about politics. I mean, these are our sharpest national security people, and they don't talk about Trumpian dystopian politics. They worry about the Chinese Communist Party and what Xi Jinping is up to. Now, that's an existential crisis, as is court packing, were it to come to pass. But I see serious Republicans worried about serious things. And I wonder, do you think maybe the Manhattan Beltway corridor is just a little Trump-obsessed?
Well, that's for sure. I mean, if you look at progressives, they want to read more about Donald Trump than they want to read about Joe Biden. Because we have this thing, negative polarization. People like to hate the people they want to hate. And so that's for sure. And I, you know, the people you mentioned, I know a bunch of them. I think they are interested in policy, but we have, there are two axes, a friend of mine says, to judge people by. One is what's their ideology, and there's from left to right, but then how much are they politics addicted? And a lot of people are not politics addicted. Most people are not. They're going about living their lives. They don't really get obsessed with it all. But then there are a bunch of people who are politics addicted, and they're on Twitter, and they're watching and obsessing over every event. And frankly, I think on the Republican side, the obsession has become more about cultural issues than about policies. And, you know, I think culture is super important, so I don't minimize that. But it becomes like culture war episodes. You know, the Dr. Seuss episodes get played up. But sometimes policy really matters, and we should care more about policies. The people you've described are policy-oriented. They want to deal with China. That seems like normal policy. But if you think the culture, the fabric of your country is just about to fall apart, that's not about policy. That's just about some sense of catastrophe. And I do think both these kinds of people exist right now in the Republican Party.
Well, look, I'm not denying that Marjorie Taylor Greene is a member of Congress. I think she'll be redistricted out of existence come the Georgia redistricting. But what I see are two Americans. One of them watch cable news, and the rest of us don't. And I just don't do it anymore because this radio show for 20 years has been dedicated to getting 5% of the 100%. And both left-wing cable and right-wing cable want 100% of the 1%. And those places have become crazy, David. They're crazy. I don't think your editorial pages are any crazier than my editorial pages at the Washington Post. There's a good cross-section of voices. They're normal people. I've known Ezra Klein, by the way, since he was in second grade. I'm glad he's joined, but I saw him play the surfing Santa in seventh grade. So I can't really get alarmed by what Ezra Klein thinks. I just don't say, I just, I don't feel what you feel about Trumpists at the ramparts waiting to hurl tar and rocks down on progressives at the wall. I just go to the movies or dinner and people are fine.
Yeah, I think that too, but then turn on Tucker. And then,
well, that's it. Don't turn on Tucker. Have you seen the ratings? Have you seen what's happened to cable?
I've seen in general, yeah. I think Tucker must still be doing pretty well.
He's number one. He's doing very well. But our friends over at CNN, and they are my friends. I worked with them through the 2016 cycle. I'm an NBC guy now, but they're my friend. They're getting slaughtered. Why do you think that is?
Because progressives are bored by Joe Biden, and they were excited
yes.
by Donald Trump.
Yes, and Republicans, even if you take Tucker at his high watermark, 4 million people. I don't think he's ever gotten 4 million, but take him at 4 million. There are 330 million Americans. It just doesn't seem to me to be real. And I since you're a smart guy and I read all your books and you're very careful with data, is there a counter argument? It's not the great silent majority. It's the overwhelming majority of people indifferent to conflict among the politically addicted.
I will say that it's hard to tell, but the intensity of, say, I had dinner with a Republican senator a week or two ago, and the intensity is that he feels is on the Tucker side. And so the people who really care and who really scare him and who send him death threats, they're on that side. And so they have a lot of power. And if you look at, to me, the big difference here is there are illiberals. There are people who are intolerant on both sides. And the wokesters are trying to do their cancel culture thing. But there have been groups on the moderate left, and I mentioned a bunch of them in the column, who have risen up to oppose the illiberal forces on their own side. And a lot of that hasn't really happened on the right. There are not forces saying, no, the January 6th people are not us. We want to have a commission to investigate that. That's just not who we are. And I think that's what needs to happen on the right.
I don't want a commission to do that. I do care about the commission on the Supreme Court that President Biden put in. That's the only radical thing I've seen that upsets me, which is the idea that we would even consider expanding the Supreme Court, which is an existential issue. That's a rule of law issue. That's a basic constitutional attack on the rule of law. And it come from the left, driven by the left. And I do worry about that. But in terms of the ordinary citizen in the ordinary town in the ordinary places of America, it's the NFL draft week. You know who's coming up after you? Terry Pluto. He's probably going to be higher ranked than you because people want to talk about the draft than they want to. My question is, do you need a road trip, David? Do you need to do what some people do and just go out like Selena Zito style and talk to people? Because I think you'll be bored. I don't think anyone will talk about stuff with you.
Well, that could be. You know, I haven't been doing the road trip. I remember, you know, I used to hit 35 states a year. That was my rule. And I would hit two or three states a week. And I remember thinking when the Trump impeachment thing was happening over Russia, I would be out in Nebraska or wherever, North Carolina, and no one was talking about it. I was like, this is going nowhere. No one cares about Trump impeachment. So that's possible. It's possible that because I can't travel, I haven't you lose a little feel. And I totally grant you that. So right now I'm relying on the data, on the polling data. But you're absolutely right. When you travel, we have a saying, if you don't go, you don't know. And so when you go out to McCook, Nebraska, you see most people care about, like, how's the swim team doing? And that's totally true. But there is a group who really care about the political war. And when normal people are living their normal lives, a small avant-garde of angry people can really have a lot of power.
Well, that is definitely true. I just think that the 1850s are not upon us. 1968 is not even upon us, although you might think so if you're in Portland or Seattle. What's upon us is dystopia. And I spent some of my time on Skid Row in L.A., which is zombie apocalypse land. And there are pressing problems in America, but they affect about 3% at either end of the spectrum. And the rest of us are going about, I mean, we're going to have a great year, right? This is going to be the biggest, you spend $6 trillion, you get something for it, even if it's not the most efficient thing you've ever seen.
Yeah, to be on an up note, I think the second half of 2021 is going to be more fantastic than we can imagine. partly just economically, as you point out, you know, we may be going broke, but we're going to have a good second half. But second, we're just going to have fun doing like stuff we took for granted. We're going
to
have fun.
Oh, I went to a movie on Saturday. I'm so happy with my boys, even though it was Mortal Kombat and one of the worst movies I've seen in 25 years. It was still fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being at a bar, and I'm 5'6", so I can't get the bartender's attention because it's so crowded. That'll be fun.
I'm looking forward to the draft downtown in Cleveland on Thursday night, end of the Browns' march to the Super Bowl. David Brooks, always a pleasure. Keep coming back. Always read David. Always worth reading in the New York Times.